Judge Ripple and I are honored to be joined this morning by the Honorable James Zagel from the United States District Court for the Northern District of Illinois, who is joining us for our sitting today. And thank you for joining us. Mr. Crimmins, the first case of the day, SEC versus Jelaine Bauer, 12-2860.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Stephen Crimmins, and I represent the defendant in this case, Jelaine Bauer. Your Honors, this is a case that arose from a single mutual fund redemption a little over 12 years ago, in October year 2000. The case was filed 9 years ago. 5 years ago, the SEC settled with all of the remaining defendants, eight of them except for Jelaine Bauer. The settlement terms were pertinent to this morning's discussion because as part of the settlement, the SEC issued an administrative order, which is in the record and it's in the docket, in which they found that the conduct in question, the nondisclosures that they had alleged, and two redemptions, one 5 days before Ms. Bauer's, one 10 days after, were negligent conduct. The standard before Your Honors is scienter for an insider trading case. The SEC has found negligence and further stated in their findings that these findings shall be binding in any proceeding in which the Securities and Exchange Commission is a party, which they are here. It was a foundation.
Is this an argument you made in your briefs?
It is, Your Honor. It's a documentary.
And this involved other insiders at the Heartland?
Yes, the others. And they left pending only Ms. Bauer. And significantly, Your Honor, they even cut that back because after they applied for and obtained summary judgment from the district court a short time after in order to facilitate the entry of relief and final judgment, they dropped all of the other claims against Ms. Bauer. Those included claims which were litigable according to the SEC's theories and the evidence that they would rely on. They were ones that were very pertinent to a claim involving mutual funds. Claims like Investment Company Act 34, misreps and omissions in mutual fund activities, Investment Advisor Act Section 206 for fraud in connection with investment advisory activities, all gone. And all that they kept, and this is memorialized in Judge Clavert's order, all that they kept was insider trading as discussed in, that's the language used, as discussed in Judge Clavert's May 25 opinion.
Are you
2011.
Making...
So what we're left with, Your Honor, and why I say that is what we're left with is the classical theory as opposed to the misappropriation theory of insider trading. That is all that was presented to Judge Clavert and all that he discussed in his decision.
Are you making any argument that if the facts are, as the SEC says they are, that the conduct is nevertheless not covered by the statute?
Yes, we are, Your Honor.
And did you make that argument below?
Yes, we did, Your Honor.
Where?
Your Honor, we made it below in three different settings. One was in the summary judgment papers before Judge Clavert. They're summarized actually in our brief at page 6 in our reply brief, page 6, footnote 2. They were in the reply brief. I'm sorry, in the briefing on summary judgment. There was also a motion to reconsider before Judge Clavert. Also, briefing on the remedy question. All three explicitly set it forth. On summary judgment, it was said that the fund had available all of the information available to Bauer. I'm sorry, that was reconsideration. Had all of the information available to Bauer, and indeed considerably more information. There is no allegation that Bauer deceptively withheld any information, and that, of course, goes to the disclosure abstain point of insider trading law requirement and element, which is central to our argument in this court. Likewise, Your Honor, we said on remedy in our brief that Bauer had no duty to disclose because the fund already had the information about itself in question in redeeming Bauer's shares. And indeed, Your Honor, in the SEC's brief, on summary judgment, the SEC said in its reply brief on summary judgment, docket 431 at page 7, quote, Ms. Bauer argues further that it is not even possible to engage in fraudulent insider trading in shares of a mutual fund. That's the SEC's brief on summary judgment at page 7, Your Honor. So we would suggest that under this Court's decision in Gimbel and the other authorities that we cite, that plainly we at least suggested it, which is the Gimbel standard. We did not waive it. And we would suggest that beyond that, Your Honor, that it's core to the element of liability. And we know that from the most recent Supreme Court case in insider trading, which, of course, is O'Hagan, in which Justice Ginsburg, speaking for six justices, the other three not disagreeing, said that deception through nondisclosure, which is what we're talking about in the disclosure restraint point, of course, disclosure through nondisclosure, says Justice Ginsburg, is central to the theory of liability. And if there is disclosure, she continued, quote, there is no deceptive device and thus no 10B violation. So it's at the core of the remedy. It has been for 50 years of insider trading enforcement, back from the very first federal insider trading case, the Katie Roberts decision in 1961, core to the liability is disclose or abstain. If you disclose, you have not committed insider trading, says the whole ring of cases over 50 years. If you have disclosed, who have you disclosed to in the classical insider case? Justice Ginsburg actually tells us that also. She says in O'Hagan at page 652, the classical theory targets a corporate insider's breach of duty to shareholders with whom the insider transacts, close quote. Insider trading liability does not fit, even as it's involved over 50 years, does not fit a mutual fund redemption. There are plenty of statutes, the Investment Company Act, Section 34, Investment Advisors Act 206, and we could go on, to deal with any nondisclosure problem in the mutual fund context. Insider trading doesn't fit for that very reason that Justice Ginsburg was talking about, the reason that when you are an employee or officer of a mutual fund, you must transact with the fund. If it's an open-ended fund, the standard mutual fund, they issue you new shares when you buy. They redeem, buy back your old shares when you want to sell. They are not an exchange. They're not an intermediary. They transact in their own right. They, obviously, being the fund, know not only what you know, but a lot more that you don't know. So the disclosure abstain model, which is the core for 50 years of insider trading liability, just doesn't fit. But there are many, many, many other provisions that do fit insider trading, that do fit mutual funds when there's a disclosure issue or any other kind of issue, from a Sienter-based issue to anything less. There's a wide range of things under the Investment Company Act, the Investment Advisors Act. That's why they're there. That's why I would suggest to your honors that in 50 years of insider trading enforcement, to our knowledge, and I believe in the citations in our adversary's brief, there has never been a federal court that has ever adjudicated a case before this one, applying insider trading principles to a mutual fund redemption. It just doesn't fit. Now, amazingly, and I don't say that critically, but I was amazed, that after we argued classical theory, essentially the core argument that we've just been talking about in our appellant's brief, which was all that was litigated over 9 years, that was all that was in the complaint, the amended complaint, all that Judge Clavert considered below, in this court on appeal, in the appellee's brief on appeal, after we had briefed our opening brief, did we first see the misappropriation theory.
Why did Ms. Bauer issue that order to the Heartland employees that they weren't to trade in the funds for the period of time if the concept of insider trading doesn't fit?
There are more disclosure obligations under the Investment Company Act and under the Investment Advisors Act, and her admonition and indeed the trading window, which Your Honor has probably seen spoken about in the briefs, the trading window has a broader frame. It's a compliance frame of reference. It's not just are we violating Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 or its corollary, Section 17A of the 33 Act. It's a broader compliance perspective. It has to do with appearance of propriety. It's a broader range. Plus, on a very practical level, it has to do with the Investment Company Act and the Investment Advisors Act and other provisions. So they did they and many other mutual funds do have a window where they opened and closed it significantly, Your Honors, as Judge Tinder has pointed out. Shortly before this, when they knew that their lead portfolio manager, the star, if you will, was going to be leaving the fund, as soon as a subset knew that, they closed the window just for the people who knew that. The day that it was actually going to be announced that he was leaving, they told all the employees at the beginning of the day, and they closed the window for everybody at the beginning of that day. At the end of that day, Your Honors, Ms. Bauer is before the board and outside counsel from Quarles and Brady, and she says, well, we've now announced that, and this applies to the misappropriation theory that's been raised more recently, we've now announced our lead portfolio manager is leaving. We've announced that our outside pricing service has knocked down the price of some of the securities in our funds significantly. We've announced that. And we've also completed a transaction, the so-called SWIP transaction, where they took some lower-ranked bonds and sold them to the State of Wisconsin Investment Board with their return guaranteed not by the fund but by the advisor's parent and its CEO. She said, That's now done. The transaction is completed and the first two items are announced. We can now lift the window selectively to a small set or a larger set, but not some. No, it was like other windows opening and closing. It was as to everybody. No objection. Outside counsel, no objection from the board. That goes to the alternative theory of misappropriation doctrine, the other kind of insider trading case that has more recently been raised on appeal by the commission, if Your Honors consider it. It's a different disclosure. Under the classical theory, as Your Honors may know from the briefs, under the classical theory, you must make a disclosure to your counterparty in the transaction of the material non-public information that you know. Very, very different in a misappropriation case. The disclosure must be the source of your information, and the disclosure must be that you are going to trade, or that you are trading. That doesn't work here either, for the reason that, first of all, 5 days before her redemption, she, in the presence of the board and outside counsel, opened the window. There's no breach of duty because the fund is saying it's okay. It will not be a breach. It will be okay for all of our people, not selectively as before, as Judge Tinder has pointed out, for all of our people to purchase if they want to purchase or to redeem if they want to redeem. No breach of duty. In addition, disclosure, first of all, on a very practical level, she worked there. So when she redeemed, if somebody thought she hadn't, first of all, when she did redeem, the record of the redemption describes her as a Heartland employee. It's recorded in the record. Additionally, she worked there for an additional 2 years. They had the power the following morning, the following week, 2 weeks later, to reverse the transaction. Say, okay, you'd like to trade. We don't think so. We're reversing it. And they held her money. They held her salary. She worked there for 2 years. A rescission would have been possible, and it wasn't done.
Under the management structure.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Under the management structure of the fund,
yes, Your Honor.
Who had the authority to close the window?
It was the board's. It had to be done. It was suggested by the general counsel, Ms. Bauer, and in the presence of the board, and with their authority,
she's
it was done.
Quite involved in that process.
She makes a recommendation as the general counsel with outside counsel there, and the board, an informed board, because remember, the information that we're talking about is supposed material non-public information, is known to the board and known to outside counsel. So it's not as though she's trying to put a fast one by them. They know the full situation. Also, they know that what the commission has referred to as a liquidity crisis, you know, maybe we have debt, maybe we can't redeem, that they know, and I believe the record will support, is solved by the SWIB transaction, the State of Wisconsin Investment Board transaction, as a result of which, the day before Ms. Bauer's redemption, their debt goes to zero, the funds. The funds have just recently had their credit line renewed, and they're allowed to borrow up to, if they have a call on the fund, in other words, a lot of redemptions, they're allowed to borrow up to one-third of their assets. and they have now gotten the tank down to zero in terms of their debt as a result of the SWIP transaction, if there were a liquidity crisis. Indeed, a term used in the Commission's appellate brief, never used by Judge Claver. I would respectfully invite the Court to look at Judge Claver's opinion. You will not see liquidity crisis. However, if that were a concern, that got taken care of as well. So for that reason, and separately, of course, as Your Honors know from the briefs, we're arguing that several half a dozen things demonstrate at least a fact issue on materiality and at least a fact issue on scienter, which would support a remand for a trial to let a jury sort that out and should not have been decided on summary judgment, we respectfully submit. However, that's apart from the strict legal point that we suggests a reversal and a dismissal, which is that there was disclosure. Disclose or abstain is the core part. I can't say enough, the core part of any insider trading claim, disclose or abstain. Under the classical theory, there was disclosure. It doesn't fit mutual fund redemptions, but if it were to hypothetically fit, there was disclosure because all the information Ms. Bauer had in her head, and indeed much more, was known to her trading counterparty, the fund, which is the only market that exists for its own shares. It has to buy them back. It is the counterparty. It's the only market, and it's the only contemporaneous trader. It's the whole show. They knew everything she did. So under disclosure of standing for the classical theory, it's satisfied. And likewise,
if we were to remand on the misappropriation theory, what evidence would Ms. Bauer have that she had disclosed her intentions to trade to someone in a decision-making position?
Well, a couple of things, Your Honor. In addition to the fact that she had the entire board and outside counsel approve that everybody could trade, as opposed to a selective subset, which happened a month earlier. In addition, the evidence would show that we actually have a tape of the conversation.
A phone call to a call center, right?
Call center, but it's to the head of the call center.
Is the head of the call center involved in the decision making at Heartland?
In the sense that if it's a trade that cannot be done, she's the head of the call center. She takes the order. She has to pass the order on, and she reports to the chief operating officer of the corporation. She knew Ms. Bauer personally, and the evidence would show that they had a discussion for about 5 minutes on a number of different things, very low key. So it was known. She duly recorded Ms. Bauer's name and that she was a Heartland employee in the records. And indeed, in terms of approval, if anybody, right up to the chief executive or the chair of the board, did not like the trade, it could have been rescinded the following morning, the following week, the following month. And indeed, in conclusion, Ms. Bauer actually, when the SEC raised questions about it sometime later, said, look, you claim I avoided a loss of $20,000. I'll put it in escrow. And for a decade that the litigation was pending, for a decade it sat in escrow until summary judgment. She was trying to do the right thing. She thought she had gotten it right. Absolutely no scienter. I save it for my rebuttal time, if I may reserve.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Yoder.
May it please the Court. My name is Stephen Yoder, and I represent the appellee of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Jelaine Bauer committed insider trading by liquidating her mutual fund investment on the basis of confidential information about a liquidity crisis, which had been entrusted to her as an officer of the fund and as general counsel and chief compliance officer of the fund's advisor. She now challenges the district court's grant of summary judgment against her. On appeal, Bauer argues that a mutual fund redemption cannot entail deception for the purpose of sustaining an insider trading charge. But Bauer waived this argument by not raising it in her summary judgment papers. Rather, she raised it only in her motion for reconsideration nearly 3 years later. This is too late. And to that effect, I would cite this Court's decision in Mungo v. Taylor from 2004. If you look at the summary judgment papers, Ms. Bauer did raise a number of arguments, but she raised them all under the guise of challenging the elements of materiality and scienter. And if you look at the district court's decision, it also reflects that same understanding. And the commission, for its part, did not decide definitively between one theory or the other. If you read the complaint, it pleads fraud. It pleads a cause of action under Section 10B and Rule 10B-5. But it doesn't decide between the classic or misappropriation theories. The Commission's summary judgment papers likewise outlined both theories, but never decided definitively between one or the other.
Your brief here does, though, and relies solely on the misappropriation theory, correct?
Your Honor, that is the only theory that our brief discusses.
So do you concede that you could not make out a classical theory insider trading case?
We do not concede that, Your Honor. We believe that the district court's judgment should be affirmed on any theory that's consistent with the record before this court.
But the only one you argue is the misappropriation.
Correct. The only one that is argued in our brief is the misappropriation theory. That's correct. If you have questions about the classical theory, I'd be happy to address them, but we focus on the misappropriation theory because we believe it provides the most direct line to liability under the record of this case.
So how could Bauer have known that you were pursuing a misappropriation theory at the district court? What would have told her that?
Sure. Our summary judgment papers, as she herself quotes them in her reply brief, outline both the classical theory and the misappropriation theory. We mentioned in passing that Bauer was a traditional insider, but we did raise the misappropriation theory at that point. We never elaborated on either theory beyond that, precisely because Bauer was not challenging deception at that stage. She was challenging that materiality could not be met because it was trading in a mutual fund. She also argued that on these facts there was insufficient evidence to grant summary judgment as to scienter, but she did not challenge deception. And our belief is that if Bauer is permitted to pursue her deception argument for the first time on this appeal, then the commission should be permitted to respond with any theory that would have been available to it in the district court. Specifically, the facts of Bauer's redemption fall squarely within the well-established bounds of the misappropriation theory. And that is because redemption secretly converted the fund's confidential information to her own personal benefit. Her counterarguments to this theory lack merit. First, she argues that the board of the fund did not object when she acted as chief compliance officer to lift the trading restriction once it became public knowledge that the portfolio manager was resigning. But no jury could reasonably find that this silence constituted consent to trade on any other information distinct from knowledge of the portfolio manager's resignation. Second, Bauer argues that she was recognized and identified as a Heartland employee when she called to place her redemption order. But this simple identification was insufficient to alert Heartland as to her imminent breach or to give Heartland a meaningful opportunity to respond. From this perspective, the tape-recorded call that she notes in her reply brief is entirely cumulative of the call log that's already in the record.
I have just a question about SEC policy.
Yes.
How often have you done this with mutual fund redemptions?
We have not done it often, Your Honor. We're not aware of any reported federal court decisions on this point. When we did our research, Bauer does note some decisions in her brief. One was an administrative law judge decision. Another was a settled matter that was filed in federal district court. But our feeling is that a straightforward application of the misappropriation theory supports liability here.
But has there not been, over the number of years, efforts by the SEC and by other enforcement agencies to draw a line which would, in fact, subject mutual fund redemptions to some of the same strictures that deal with stock in an ordinary corporation? And so far as I'm aware, none of those efforts have succeeded with the Congress.
It is correct that there have been certain efforts made that did not succeed in Congress. But as we argue in our brief, Congress's failure to act is inconclusive in terms of deciding whether liability should apply under Section 10B.
But is there not a significant difference between a circumstance in which some issue is raised in the abstract or Congress never considers the issue, in which case it's classical inaction, and a situation in which an effort was made and Congress turned it back?
We would agree it's obviously a different circumstance, but we believe there are different inferences that can be drawn from Congress's failure to act following its consideration. For example, Congress's failure to act could reflect its understanding that this form of misconduct was already prohibited by Section 10B. It could also reflect Congress's judgment that this sort of misconduct would be extremely rare because of the way that net asset value is typically calculated in a mutual fund. But our judgment is that this case does, in fact, present the unusual situation.
When Congress did have this legislation before it,
yes,
had the SEC taken a position on the applicability of the law as it existed at that time to mutual funds?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of a public position of the SEC at that time.
So Congress could not turn to the agency charged with the administration of the statute and say, well, they're already taken care of it, we don't need to act.
I mean, Congress obviously was free to consult with the Commission about its views on this matter. I have to confess, I'm not aware of whether Congress attempted to do that in this particular circumstance.
Looking just at the papers filed in the litigation in the district court.
Yes.
How was the defendant here put on notice? How was Ms. Bauer put on notice that you were pursuing this case against her under the misappropriation theory?
Yes, Your Honor. If you look at the passage that she quotes in her reply brief, she quotes from our summary judgment papers, and in that passage we lay out, albeit briefly, we lay out both the classical and the misappropriation theories. And we believe that that was sufficient to put her on notice that we were asserting liability under either theory. Ms. Bauer also challenges the grant of summary judgment as to materiality and scienter. As to materiality, it is difficult to imagine what could be more important to a mutual fund investor than the possibility of losing access to the mutual fund investment. On this record, Bauer's own admissions show she knew this was a very real possibility. First, Bauer admitted in her letter to the Commission the day before she redeemed that the board of Heartland was actively considering suspending redemptions or selling or merging the municipal bond funds. Second, Bauer was aware that the funds were forced to take discounts on the carrying values of bonds in order to sell them fast enough to pay out redeeming investors. She admitted in an email 5 days before her redemption that it was difficult to restructure portfolios because, quote, all cash raised is used to pay out redemptions, but we can't say that, end quote. Third, Bauer knew about increases in levels of illiquid securities in the funds. She admitted in an email the day after her redemption that, quote, this info is non-public, could be material, and can be shared, but not selectively, end quote. As to scienter, Bauer was a securities lawyer with 2 decades of experience in the mutual fund industry. She was the general counsel and chief compliance officer of Heartland, with responsibility for implementing Heartland's insider trading policy. And she admitted in her testimony that she applied that policy to restrict trading in the mutual funds themselves when people at Heartland had material non-public information about those funds. So Bauer knew exactly what she was doing when she redeemed. In addition, she admitted her primary reason for redeeming was to protect her assets because of concern about volatility.
She may have known that there were all other compliance problems, but did she know she was violating this particular statute or these particular statutes?
We believe that her admissions show that she did, Your Honor. If you look at her testimony, she says that she that she was applying the Heartland insider trading policy to restrict trades in shares of the funds. I don't recall her ever testifying that it was because of other compliance concerns that she was putting these restrictions in place.
Did the SEC ever announce, make a policy statement, as they sometimes do, with respect to the kind of liability that might occur? And particularly, and I'm not talking simply about mutual fund redemptions, your theory is that what she knew was a liquidity crisis that might drive the fund out of business.
Correct.
Did the SEC ever issue public advice with respect to what should be done in that circumstance? And I ask this because, generally speaking, you're kind of, and I think you're conceding that in most cases of mutual fund redemptions, you're not going to have the classical situation occur, which is why you finally went to misappropriation. Did the SEC make a policy statement?
I'm not aware of any such policy statement, Your Honor. And for these reasons, we believe that on this record there could be no genuine dispute that Bauer acted with Scienter in redeeming her investment. And, Your Honor, just to return to the opening point about deception, what we're dealing with here is a judgment that Ms. Bauer violated Section 10B and Rule 10B-5. That judgment does not specifically adopt either theory. It says she's liable. We believe that judgment should be affirmed on any theory that's consistent with the record before this court. And if there are no further questions.
With this misappropriation theory,
yes.
Then it would be pretty difficult for any employee of a fund, or at least at a high level of a fund, to trade in that fund. Am I understanding that correctly? Because there's always going to be information that's not yet public.
Our belief is that it could be a concern for people who are in a high level within the fund, but under the misappropriation theory, the solution is relatively simple. The person who possesses non-public material information would simply need to seek pre-clearance from the fund. That is, would have to disclose to the source of the information about their plans to trade based on that information. And that disclosure would negate the element of deception, and then they could go ahead to trade. So we don't believe that it would be an onerous burden in any sense. The person in question would just have to pre-clear the trade before going through with it.
And that would accomplish what?
Sure. It would give the fund a chance to say, no, we don't approve of this, we don't like this, please stop it. It would give the fund notice as to what exactly was going on so that they could take any appropriate corrective action. For example, that's what it would do in that instance. It would put the fund on notice, and by putting them on notice, it would avoid the problem of deception.
And is one of the corrective actions a cancellation of a redemption, as Mr. Crimmins suggested?
In some circumstances, it could be cancellation. The record here is not clear as to why Ms. Bauer's trade was not canceled after the fact. We do know that the funds entered receivership in a matter of months after her redemption. And we also know that as the facts of Ms. Bauer's conduct came to light, Heartland asked her to leave in 2002. If there are no further questions, we'll rest our case.
Mr. Crimmins, how much time is left? 2 minutes?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, 2 minutes?
2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, just to respond very, very briefly to the point that Judge Zagel and Judge Ripple made about congressional action, as said in our brief, Congress did enact Section 17J of the Investment Company Act, and what they said there was that in controlling trading by fund insiders, it will apply to portfolio securities, the stock that the mutual fund itself owns. They did not take the extra step and say that it should apply to shares of the fund itself. What's even more interesting is that when the SEC, and it was 10 years later, they finally did the enabling rule. When they did it 10 years later, Rule 17J1, they originally said, okay, Congress said we can only regulate trading in the portfolio held by the fund. Gosh, some of the securities the fund will hold will be regular common stock and bonds, but some of it will be shares of other funds. Funds own shares of other funds. Why don't we include them too? That was in their proposing release. In their final release, they said, no need for that. We don't have to worry about shares of other funds that would be in the portfolio. We'll cut that out in our final rule. The point is, Your Honors, that they did not put it in. They could have acted in that area. They could have adopted all kinds of rules under 17 or under other sections where they do have rulemaking authority, could have put in things about restrictions on trading, preclearance of trading, all different kinds of things they didn't. It shouldn't be done. I would respectfully submit for a redemption 12 years late after the fact in an enforcement case. Ms. Bauer tried to get it right. She was a decent compliance person for virtually her entire career, including almost 20 years at a fund before that and years at this one. Since this time, she's been economically, as you can imagine, hardship litigating with the SEC. She still tried to work in the compliance area, advise people on compliance. She has never had any legal trouble at all except for parking tickets and one speeding ticket. She's a good person. She was trying to get it right. I would respectfully suggest to Your Honor that she didn't violate the law. Thank you.
All right. Thank you to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.